Okay, we'll do the invocation to Sage Patanjali. So you can either read on the screen and sing along or just listen quietly. Inhale. Yogen chittasya paden vacham malam sharirasya cha vaidyakena yopakarottam pravaram muninam patanjalim pranjaliran tosmi patanjalim pranjaliran tosmi. Let's open the eyes, and one of you, Rangarajan, you want to read the translation in English?
Oh, yeah. Okay, it says that I respectfully bow down with folded hands and offer my salutation to Sage Patanjali, the highest among the munis, sages, who has presented the remedies for removing the impurities of body through its treatise on Ayurveda, of language through this treatise on grammar, Patanjali Mahabhashya, am I spelling it right?
Mahabhashya.
Mahabhashya. And the impurities of the chitta, mind field, through his treatise on yoga, Yoga Sutra of Patanjali.
Very good. So that's normally, you know, we always you do this invocation to Patanjali because he's given a lot of credit here to different sciences of human endeavor. So, you know, we always start with that. So, all study of Patanjali.
Oh, the capital A, what's the difference in the capital A and the lowercase A? Is that just where you're supposed to put stress when you pronounce it? Or?
Capital A simply means it's a long sound, pra. So, if you read the word pranjali, instead of pranjali, it will become pranjali. If it is a lowercase a, it will be Pranjali. Which one are you looking at?
I was just looking at the translation of the Sanskrit.
I know, but which letter?
V-A-C-H-A-N.
Okay, so that's why. So it's instead of vacham, it is vacham. So the A sound is prolonged. That's what the capital A represents.
Okay.
It's just an aid in pronunciation. See, if you don't put the A, the capital A, the small letters, lowercase A would be vacham.
Same Not, thing for the M. Anytime you see a capital.
Capital is because there's a dot on top. That's just.
Oh, that's a different way. Okay.
This is the Sanskrit language.
With the dot on top too.
Yeah. Okay, that's the Sanskrit alphabet. There's a dot on top. Okay. So what for those who are here after a long time or first time, what we've been doing is to study the sutras one sutra at a time. not in the same sequence as they are given in the text, but I've kind of broken them into different topical interests as they are grouped in the text, and we've been studying in that sequence then. So we first did part of chapter 1, then we moved all the way to part of chapter 2 at the end, which is the 8 limbs of yoga or the niyamas, yamas and all that. So we finished that part. Then we, because there was a discussion on the Ishvara, so we switched back to the sutras on Ishvara. We spent a lot of time on that. And then we went back to the concept of meditation and studied a lot of sutras on meditation. So it's been kind of back and forth, but depending on the topic, I've been picking sutras from the text, not in, like I said, not in the same running sequence as they have in the text. So now we started working on chapter 2, which is this entire theory of kleshas. Kleshas are the afflictions or the pains or the sufferings or the stresses and strains that we go through in life. So what are the causes of that suffering and what what represents that suffering in our mind. Plus, it goes into a fair amount of depth in the whole concept of karma theory. Karma, reincarnation, rebirth, etc., etc., all those are concepts which are talked about by Patanjali in the chapter 2. And from the karma theory, he transitions to developing and understanding the concepts which are borrowed from the Sankhya philosophy. So currently we are in that phase where we are going to start going deep into the Sankhya philosophy. What is Sankhya philosophy? What does the word mean? Literally means numbers. So it's a philosophy which relates with a lot of numbers. You know, there are 8 of so and so, 5 and so, and 3 of so and so, and etc., etc., you know. So that's the kind of numerical listings that they talk about. And then they go, of course, into lots of depth in explaining what these are. But Sankhya is one of these 6 philosophical streams of Indian thinking, Indian thought. Okay, so not that we're going to go into any of these 6. I mean, we're just going to mention the names, so at least you know the reference to context. So does anybody know the 6? Darshanas, they are called darshana, or the philosophical streams of Indian thought.
Is Vedanta one?
Yes, Vedanta is one of them, that's right. Okay. Vedanta is one of them, very good. What else? Nyaya, very Vaisheshika. So Nyaya and Vaisheshika, they kind of go, they're pairs of 2 each. So Nyaya and Vaisheshika, they go together. Vedanta and Mimamsa, they go together.
Yoga
and Sankhya, they go together. Okay? Because what Patanjali did was he took the very basic tenets, basic concepts from the Sankhya philosophy, and then built his own yoga philosophy on top of that. Yoga, you know, what Patanjali built is more of a practical approach to yoga than just a philosophical, dry philosophical statement. So it's a combination of, you think of it as a combination of philosophy, psychology, methodology for the practice of yoga. Because he emphasizes practice.
Now, is yoga talked about in the other philosophies as well?
Not so much.
Not so much.
But there are some concepts which are presented in the Patanjali's yoga which are common to many of the concepts there. I mean, the concept of self-realization is common to everything.
All of them, yeah.
Okay.
Well, even Christianity.
Hmm?
Even Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, the whole goal of all these philosophical thoughts is self-realization. That's the ultimate goal in everything. The approaches are different, the concepts are different, and so for example, you know, you mentioned the word Vedanta. You know, in Vedanta there are multiple schools. Some are called Advaita Vedanta, some are called Dvaita. So they are dualism and non-dualism and all that stuff. So for example, in the non-dualistic Vedanta, which is the most commonly studied style of Vedanta, there's only one entity which is real. It's called Brahman.
Brahman.
Brahman, right? That's the Vedanta philosophy. Whereas in the yoga philosophy, there are 2 entities which are real.
Purusha
and Prakriti. And Prakriti. So they are both real and eternal, beginningless. Whereas in Vedanta, there's only one entity which is eternal and beginningless, which is Brahman. Okay, so there are a few similar major differences between different philosophies. Okay, and Patanjali, like I said, took some of the very basic concepts, including the concept of Purusha and Prakriti, which were the main focus in Sankhya, and brought them into the Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, yoga philosophy. Gita is mostly derived from the Upanishads. Most of the concepts in Gita are derived from some of the underlying philosophies or philosophical thoughts in the Upanishads.
How does that relate to the six philosophies? How does that relate to the six
philosophies? Everything relates back to the Vedas, everything.
Okay.
So you can say that Vedas kind of are the mother of all these systems, okay? And then the essence of Vedic understanding is in the Upanishads.
Okay.
So in that sense, Upanishads become the kind of the basis for everything that we study here. All these six darshanas, all these six philosophical streams, they have drawn their inspiration from the Vedas and the Upanishads, concepts from there, and then expanded them to kind of cater to different, you know, styles of people, different groups of people who have different ideas and all that, and injected their own thought stream into these to develop their own philosophical stream. Okay? Patanjali's focus was the mind, so he focused only on the mind, nothing else. Okay? So, depending on what the focus is, like Nyaya and Vaisheshika, their focus is on the properties of matter. So that's what they focus on. Alright.
The reason I ask is, I think Bhagavad Gita references Brahman as well as Prakriti.
Yeah. Like I said, all these concepts are there.
Okay.
Similar concepts are there, but again, interpretation is different. Gita interpreted by Advaita Vedantins is very different from those interpreted by the dualists. So everyone is different. Okay. So we're going to jump into it now. So I know it'll feel kind of weird for you guys. You haven't been to the background. So let me very quickly kind of rush through these slides so you have an idea of what I mean. Okay. So the chapter 2 starts with this whole concept of Kriya Yoga and, you know, Tapas, Swadhyaya, Ishvara Pranidhana, those are the three components of the practice of yoga called the Kriya Yoga. Okay? So that's what it starts with. Tapa is the, what is tapas? Austerities.
Austerity, discipline.
Discipline, toughness. Swadhyaya is self-study or self-understanding. Ishvara Pranidhana is surrender to God, etc., etc. So these are the three components of what Patanjali calls Kriya Yoga. And what he says is that Kriya Yoga helps us minimize the obstacles, minimize the afflictions, minimize the pains and sufferings that we go through in life, as well as bring us close enough to the state of samadhi. I'm going through these very quickly, just to give you a little background, okay? We've already spent a fair amount of time on these, but it's a good idea to kind of get a little background on where we stand. So what he says is that the practice of those three elements, tapas, swadhyaya, and ishvara pranidhana, will take you to a point where you can start feeling the essence of samadhi. Also, it will help you eliminate some of the sufferings, kleshas, stresses and strains in life that we go through. Okay. Now, what are these sufferings and kleshas? There are five kleshas that Patanjali talks about, five of them. Klesha is, like I said, suffering. Okay, klesha is the term, Sanskrit term for suffering, affliction, pain. In the modern terminology, we call it stress. That's what suffering is, stress. And so what is the main cause of all the stress? He says there are five of these. Avidya. Avidya is what?
Ignorance.
Ignorance, not knowing who I am, what my true identity is, what my true nature is, that I don't know. I'm totally confused with my own body, my own breath and mind, and that's the confusion I always have. You know, I treat everything as if this is just exactly who I am. That's called avidya, not knowing the reality. And you know, that's what avidya is. Then asmita is what?
Ego.
Asmita means ego. Ego is the one which causes all the problems eventually in life, okay? That's ego. And what's raga and dvesha?
Strong likes.
Strong likes and strong dislikes. Raga is attachments, strong likes, and which cause attachments to different objects, different entities in life. And dvesha is just the opposite, hatred or dislike or aversion or, you know, just, I don't want to do anything to do with it, you know. That's kind of the word for, that's the meaning for dvesha, okay? And the final, fifth element is abhinivesha. What's abhinivesha?
Fear of death.
Fear of death. So fear of change, fear of death, fear of losing my own, you know, this is mine, this is who I am. So losing that, fear of loss, basically. That's caused the element of abhinivesha. So, what Patanjali says, these are the five reasons why we suffer in life. Starting with the avidya. Avidya is the ignorance of not knowing my true identity. Okay? So, this one, all it says is avidya is the mother of all these problems. That's all it's saying. Avidya is the main root cause of all these problems that we listed here. Okay? Now, this one simply says that, you know, what avidya is defined as. Avidya is defined as something which makes you treat something which is impermanent as permanent, something which is not very good for you as good for you, something which is not real, that is unreal, but you treat it as real, and you think this whole body is me, this whole mind, this intellect, that's all me. That's all unreal, but that's what makes us believe because of that avidya. All right? Is this angle okay? Or
yes.
You can see that, right? Yeah. Okay. And what is asmita? How is ego defined here? This is where we go into that whole Sankhya philosophy. Remember, we went into a long discussion of Sankhya philosophy to explain this sutra, because this is very deep rooted in the concept of Sankhya. Purusha and Prakriti. Purusha is the soul, Atma, or the self, capital S. And Prakriti is everything else. My mind, body, this whole material universe, this is all part of Prakriti. Okay? And what it's saying is that asmita or ego represents the identification with this mind-body complex. I'm not able to identify with my true nature, which is Purusha, which is the Atma, which is the soul. I'm not able to do that because of avidya, because of ignorance. I'm not able to do that, but I'm able to identify myself with my mind, body, and intellect. I believe that's who I am. If my mind goes crazy, I go crazy. If my body hurts, I hurt. Okay? So, and all I'm interested in is making my body beautiful, my body and mind sharp and everything, but I don't recognize that there is something much more basic, which is me, which is my own true identity, and that's the Purusha. So it is the identification of myself with these artificial, so to say, artificial entities, which is what asmita is all about. Can you read that?
And that those were the two, I mean, like the Prakriti is like the material things, but I think I'm confused where that the Purusha is the only thing that is everlasting and that the Prakriti is the thing that...
So, good question. But that again takes us to the very basic understanding of Sankhya.
Okay.
Because in the Prakriti, there is something called Mula Prakriti.
Okay.
And actually, that's what we're going to talk about in today's session, because that's where it's leading us to. But let me just explain very quickly. There is something called mula. Mula means root or basic, or the unmanifest. That's another term they use, unmanifest prakriti, which is what it was before the whole creation started, before this whole human creation happened. You can think of it as the seed. But what the seed is, it's a balanced state of the three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas. Okay? When these three are in a state of balance completely, then it remains only in the form of a seed. It doesn't give you the fruit.
Okay. Is it unmanifest?
It's unmanifest. Okay. That's what it's called, unmanifest or mula prakriti. Okay, in Sanskrit they call it avyakta. Avyakta means not expressed. Unexpressed, unmanifest. Okay, they call it avyakta. That's the Sanskrit term for that mula prakriti. Okay, now when that imbalance happens, now there is absolutely nowhere any explanation of how that imbalance happens. It just happens. At time t equal to zero, then imbalance happens, and then the whole creation starts. Okay, and that's where we talk about those 23 elements, etc. And we will come to that today. Okay. Okay, so that's the reason that you think that it's beginningless or not beginningless. Everything else that manifests has a beginning and has an end, but unmanifest has no beginning.
And no end.
That's why these two are real and perpetual. Okay. Purusha and Prakriti. That's why it's called a dualistic philosophy. Okay? As opposed to the other philosophies. Does that help you? Okay, so that's Asmita. Now, what is raga and dvesha? That's all based on our life experiences. You know, when we experience life, every experience, either we like it or we dislike it. Every experience in life, no matter what it is. The ego is powerful enough to put a label on every experience. That's what the ego does. You come to this class, for example, you know, you are attending this class on a beautiful sunny Saturday afternoon, and you go back and, you know, there will be an element attached to that experience. I liked it. I hated it. I wasted my afternoon. I enjoyed my afternoon. You know, those are the things that are already mentioned in your data bank. They get embedded all the time. So, you know, 2 years from now, you will recollect that. And whenever that recollection comes, that label will be there. I had enjoyed it. Maybe I should go back. I hated it. I don't want to go back. It's a waste of time. All that is already put in that memory bank. Okay? So when you put a label that I liked it, you develop an attachment to it. That's called raga. So when it's a pleasant, likable experience, then you get attached to that experience. You want it more. That's how we develop habits. All the habits that we have. You would drink coffee at 7 in the morning. Why? Because first cup of coffee, the experience was good. Okay? And that gets labeled there. Good experience. Attachment. Next time, a little more attachment. And then after that, you're hooked to it. Then it becomes a habit. If you don't get a coffee in the morning at 7 o'clock, you get a headache. You can't go to the bathroom or whatever, you know. A lot of things happen. Right? You get the idea. Same thing with every habit that we have. It's all based on raga and dvesha. Dvesha is the opposite of it. You have an experience and you dislike it, you develop a hatred for it, dislike for it. You kind of averse to it. That's what raga and dvesha are. It's all based on our experiences in life that we go through. Okay. Then abhinivesha is the desire to maintain, you know, the literal meaning of abhinivesha can be roughly translated as maintaining status quo. Okay, that's roughly its meaning. wish is to enter, abhinivesh is to stay in something. And okay, so that's how it is derived, is to stay
in.
No change. You're in a comfort zone, stay that way, it's okay. Change is, you know, fearful. You never know what's going to happen. That fear of change, okay, and then eventual fear of change is the fear of death. So most commentators equate abhinivesha to the fear of death or the desire to maintain life forever. Okay, so that's what it is. And then it says that even the most wisest of people, even the people who have close to attained yoga, even they are afraid of death.
There is going to be an attachment, right?
There's going to be an attachment, and that's the problem.
Even the good experience.
Yeah, whatever pleasant experience you have, okay, you get attached to it. That's a problem. Problem in the sense that if there is a, you know, there is a vasana attached to it. Vasana means a desire to repeat that experience because it was pleasurable, okay. And you let's say you went on a vacation to Hawaii and you had a very beautiful experience, and 2 years later you want to do that again. And it's a very beautiful experience, so you book a flight and everything. On the last moment, flight gets cancelled. Okay, you're miserable. But that misery comes because of the attachment. That's all. You know. So attachment or aversion, they're both based on the ego, and they're both cause for suffering. And the next sutra is going to tell you that. Not the next, but sometime later. Okay. So, these are some of the remedies, you know. These kleshas, these sufferings, they can be either very subtle or they can be a little gross. So those that are subtle, they can be eliminated by reversing them back to, you know, we went through this in some depth. So I'm going to skip this because this takes a long, lot of discussion. Let's skip this for the time being. We might come back to these. Okay. This is an important sutra because it kind of defines what the karma theory is. Okay? So, what it's saying is that whatever we do, okay, it gets stored in the bag of karma. You know, it's like a storage bag or a data bank. So whatever we do, those get stored as karma. And then they are labeled good karma, bad karma, punya or apunya, etc., etc. Okay, those are the labels that get attached to every karma that we go through. And then what it says is that these karmas, eventually they will bring fruit either in this life or in a future life. There's no way to determine what will happen when. Okay, but that's how this whole karma theory is built on. Who decides that? Then nobody mentions that. In our culture, you know, they gave a name, Prajapati or somebody. You might have heard the term. Okay, there's somebody called Prajapati sitting somewhere up there, and he has a complete record of everybody's bank balance in this universe. Every entity, every living entity, whether it's an animal, insect, bird, human being, no matter what. Okay? And then at the time of birth, it's going to allocate some part of that karma and then allocate for this particular lifespan, and then that called the prarabdha karma. How this happens, I don't understand. I don't think anybody does in this universe. But that's how it is explained. Okay? So this is the whole concept of karma theory, which is kind of an embedded part of the philosophy given by Patanjali. Okay? So they manifest in these three characterizations, three: jati, ayuhu, and bhoga. So Whatever you do, whatever our karmas are, whatever that bag full of karmashaya is, okay, karmashaya is the bag full of karmas, all the things that we do, we have done in the past and what we are supposed to get. Three attributes of this result. Jati means what species you will be born into. Whether you will be born as a human being, as an insect, animal, donkey, whoever, you know. Okay, that's jati. Ayu means?
Lifespan.
How long you're going to live in that particular species, lifespan. And bhoga means?
Experiences.
What kind of?
Experience.
What kind of experience you're going to have? Pleasant, unpleasant, good, bad, likable, dislikable, etc., etc. So that's the. So those are the three attributes of your future life that Patanjali has talked about here. Jati, Ayu and Bhoga. Okay. So, this is a standard statement from all Hindu parents. They always tell the kids, you know, when they grow up, hey, if you do good stuff, you will get good phala, good karma. If you do bad stuff, you will do bad phala, bad karma. Okay. That's basically what it is. Okay, good and bad are based on your own good and bad actions. Okay, and what defines good and bad actions? Who determines what's good and what's not good? It's again based on our shastras, as they say. Whatever is represented as good in our Shastra. Shastra means all the ancient scriptures, these big scriptures like Vedas and Upanishads and Bhagavad Gita and Yoga Sutra and all. Whatever they say is a good deed, that's considered good. Okay? There are Dharma Shastras, as they call them, Dharma Shastra. Dharma is to follow a certain lifestyle. That's Dharma. So Dharma Shastras are there from the ancient times, Manu Shastras, Manu Smriti and all that. So whatever they contain, that's what you follow. That's considered to be good. Otherwise, no good. So if you do good deeds, you get good results. Painful otherwise. Okay? So this is the one where we did some discussion last time, and it says that it doesn't matter whether the experience is good or bad. It's eventually all painful. That's what this statement says. That no matter what experience you have, no matter what, eventually everything is painful. Like I said, you know, if you have a pleasant experience in coffee and you don't get the coffee and you're miserable because you can't go to the toilet or you get a headache or you're just miserable otherwise. That's what the whole concept of attachment and dvesha is. Okay? You have a neighbor who you don't get along with. It's painful, but you can't do nothing about it. You're miserable, and you cannot do anything about it. You have a fight every day. It's going to be painful, suffering. Pretty much what it says is, no matter what it is, every pleasurable experience is temporary. Every painful experience is temporary, but it's there. But it's all painful eventually. Suffering. Why is it suffering? Because of the reason given is that there is all these things, there's constant change going on in life. Parinama is constant change. There's tapa is again pain in some form. Okay, sanskaras. Remember, the sanskaras are the, what are sanskaras?
Impressions.
Stored impressions in our, that's the karmashaya. Karmashaya is the bag of karmas. And it's all samskaras in there. So because of all that, plus these gunas, everyone knows the three gunas?
Rajas, tamas and?
Sattva.
Sattva,
rajas and tamas. Now these gunas are constantly in flux. They're constantly changing. This moment maybe sattva guna is more dominant, more prevalent in you. And that's the reason you decided to come here. Or you could have changed your mind and, you know, your kids take over, Rajas takes over, and you decide to go and have a football game with the kids, etc., etc. These things happen, right? So there's a constant struggle between these three gunas, but eventually they all lead to eventually to suffering, no matter what it is. That's what this sutra says. There's a lot of controversy about this sutra, but everyone finally believes that it's okay, because no matter what you do, eventually it is suffering, unless you are self-realized. Until then, everything is painful. Okay. All right. So this is where are we going to start today now. All right. So up to 15 is where we did last time. Yes. So now we'll do the number 16. So first the Sanskrit. So repeat after me. Heyam. Dukkham. Anagatam. Heyam. Dukkham. Anagatam. Okay. What's heyam mean? Heyam means something that can be prevented. Something that's avoidable. That's heyam. Dukkham means?
Pain.
Pain, suffering. Suffering. Okay, suffering. So avoidable is suffering. Which kind of suffering? Anagatam. Which hasn't happened yet. It might happen tomorrow or the very next moment, but it hasn't happened yet. So the suffering that may happen tomorrow is avoidable. So any future suffering is avoidable. What does that mean? That means the present, if you are suffering presently something, then you're going through anyway. Right? If you're having suffering now, you have a physical pain or that's causing suffering, or some problem with your family or some problem with your boss. Okay? If it is already kind of going on, you're going through it. You probably have to go deal with it. And that will change depending on your understanding. If it was something in the past, you can do nothing about it. It's already gone. So you cannot repair suffering from the past. You cannot do a whole lot from what you're going through now. But what it says is, if it hasn't happened yet, you can prevent it.
Can you give an example? I'm not fully getting this. Can you give an example of a pain that has not come yet?
Suffering that has not come yet?
Yeah. Can you give an example?
Everything is possible. You can get fired.
To the dentist.
But how is it going to be avoided?
That's what he's going to talk about.
No.
Okay? There may be talk about layoffs in the company. I'm just picking a random example, right? There may be talk about layoffs in the company. Now, it's already causing suffering in your mind. Oh my God, what's going to happen? How am I going to support my family? My kids are in college, and how am I going to pay for them? This and that. You know, you're already suffering from that. But that suffering can be avoided. You may not prevent your getting laid off. But the suffering that you being caused because of that thought, that can be avoided. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I was just going to say, the example like going to the dentist, you know you're going tomorrow and you're draining it, but don't let it ruin your day today.
That's exactly the point.
I mean, today you're not going, so just enjoy your day and just deal with it tomorrow.
That's the point. Okay. So suffering that has not happened yet, you can prevent it. Okay. So again, most commentators, they like to equate this with the four noble truths of Buddhism, right? So there is suffering which is avoidable, then there is a cause for that suffering. Right? And then there is a liberation that's possible, liberation from that suffering that's possible. And how do you get to that liberation or avoiding that suffering? Okay? So like I said, past suffering is already gone. Current suffering is already taking effect. And the future suffering can be avoided by using proper means. Okay. Now, what it's saying is, this is all, you know, based on the commentaries that I read, okay? Because these sutras are so cryptic, so short and brief, that it's impossible to understand on your own. You have to read commentaries to understand the sutras, right? So this is what the sutras, the commentators talk about. Say, the normal man, they are not very sensitive to future suffering, okay? We don't think of that as future suffering, okay? We suffer, but we don't think of it as suffering. But when you start becoming a sharp yogi, then it becomes like an eyeball, it says. That's the example the Vyasa gives. An eye, like, even if there's a small hair in the eyeball, touching the eyeball, it's very painful. Right? So only the eyeball can determine something which is painful, which may not be painful anywhere else. If there is a hair on my shirt or on my skin somewhere else, nothing, no problem. Only when it's in the eye, it's very painful. Unless it's gone, you're not comfortable. So yogi understands these concepts much better. Yogi means one who has cleansed his mind, purified his mind. He or she, they understand the concepts of suffering much better than a normal person. Normal person, they just suffer through it. You know, when suffering happens, they just go through it, cry, you know, foul, miserable, they become miserable, and then go on with life. Okay? So that's what they first commented. So it's same, they say, principle of cause and effect. If you can know the cause, then you can eliminate the suffering, because suffering is an effect of something. Okay? So that's what that whole statement is. Now, we also talked about this is the same thing that keeps coming up. There are three types of suffering people go through. Everyone knows these words: adhyatmika, adhi daivika, adhi bhautika. These are the three types of suffering. Most texts will mention these three. What are these? Does anybody remember these? What's adi bhautika?
Physical causes.
Physical causes. So somebody hurts you by throwing a stone at you, putting a knife in your skin, or, you know, just causing damage in some way. Physical, you get hurt, you step on a stone or something, you know, that's hurting. That's adi bhautika. What's adhyatmika? Self-imposed. Adhyatmika is all the suffering that I go through, either self-imposed or through my own body. So if I have 104 fever, that's adhyatmika. But more importantly, they say, mental suffering is caused by myself.
Now, what did you say, the fever? Remember that?
Same thing, adhyatmika.
Fever is self-imposed?
Well, I mean, it's causing on the self itself. Nobody else is causing it.
I guess I would, yeah.
It's, in some sense, it's self-imposed.
I guess, yeah, I can see where you would go with that.
Okay. If you're very healthy, you probably won't get fever, but if you're not healthy, you get fever. But if you're not healthy because you're not taking care of yourself, etc.
Right, right. As opposed to something that, like a rock falls on your foot or something.
Right.
I see what you mean.
And so that's adhyatmika. Adi bhautika is physical. What's adi daivika? What's an example of adi daivika suffering?
Hurricanes,
fires, tsunamis, earthquakes, plagues, you name it, you know, all these things, which you have no control over. Or there is an extreme heat wave, extreme cold wave. You suffer.
This is why we say
Shanti three times, always. We say Shanti three, Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Always we say it three times. That's because we want to eliminate these three kinds of suffering: adhyatmika, adhi bhautika, and adhi daivika. Those are the three types of suffering. Very good. So again, heyam dukkham anagatam, that means the suffering that has not yet come is avoidable. That's the sutra. Okay, this is the next one now. Let's do the Sanskrit first. Drashtra.
Drashtra.
Drishyayoho.
Drishyayoho.
Sanyogaha.
Sanyogaha.
Heya.
Heya.
Hetuhu.
Hetuhu.
So drashtra.
Drashtra.
Drishyayoho.
Drishyayoho.
Sanyogaha.
Sanyogaha.
Heya hetuhu.
Heya hetuhu.
Okay, what does it mean now? Drashtra. Drashtra means the one who sees, the seer, observer, the onlooker. And drishya is what is being seen. So, there is a seer and there is a seen, and try to think that they are the same. Sanyogaha. Sanyogaha means union. So the union of or perceived union of the seer and the seen is the reason. Hetu means reason. For heya, like I said, heya means avoidable. For something that is avoidable, that pain that has not yet come, which is avoidable, the reason for that is the identification of the seer with the seen. Does that mean anything?
So, I guess go back to self-realization.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Seer is who? Purusha. Seer is the soul, Atma, Purusha. Okay? Seen is the Prakriti, which is all the mind, body, intellect, this whole material aspect of being. Now, perceived oneness between the seer and the seen. That means I'm identifying myself with my body, mind, and intellect. That's what we said earlier, right? It's my identification, false identification with my mind, with my body, with my intellect, okay, which is making the ego very strong. And because of that, I'm suffering. So the identification of this material being, which is called drishya or prakriti, okay, with the purusha or the soul or the atma or the self, that's the cause of this whole suffering. Union. You know, when I occasionally give talks to these yoga students who are going through a teacher's training program in a couple of studios, my general question is, what's the definition of yoga? Okay? And in majority of the cases, they'll jump up, they'll say, union of mind, body, and soul. Yeah. You probably heard that statement, right?
Yeah.
Union of mind, body, and soul. They say it blindly. When I ask them to explain what it means, it's total silence. They have no clue what it means. All they have is, they heard the statement that union of mind, yoga means union. Yoga means, it comes from the Sanskrit root word is yuj. Y-U-J, yuj. Yuj means to join together something. Okay, so union. So they have heard that much. So they say, okay, yoga means union. When I ask union of what? Oh, mind, body, and soul. What does that mean? They have no clue. Well, guess what this statement says? The union of mind, body, and soul is the culprit, is the main root cause of all suffering.
I thought about it like that.
It's Patanjali.
Yeah.
Okay.
So how not to yoga?
This is exactly... So the whole concept of the practice of yoga is disunion, basically.
Learn yoga to not yoga.
Yes. disunion. Because unless we can understand the total separation between these two entities, we are not self-realized. The whole purpose of self-realization, the term that he used now, the purpose of self-realization is to understand that Purusha and Prakriti are separate. They are close to each other. They are in close proximity of each other. That is required for their functioning. That close proximity is required. But it's the union, it's the superimposition of one over the other, which is the ultimate cause of all suffering. All this pain and suffering is happening because we are superimposing one on the other. Okay? But understand that, that is the whole objective of the practice of yoga. So instead of saying blindly mind, body and soul, think about it, you know. So when I tell them that this is exactly what the sutra says, say, oh my God, you know.
What?
Never thought of that. Okay. What do I have here? The very first entrance I made here, refute the common misconception, yoga is the union of body, mind and soul. Okay? Now, you know, this is a very kind of a, in my own understanding, it's a very complex subject. And I have to admit that I don't have a very full or a deep understanding of this whole concept, how it all works. I'm still struggling to get there slowly. Okay? Because Sankhya is not easy to understand, you know, at this level. But what it's saying is, first of all, only Purusha, only the soul has consciousness. This whole intellect complex, mind, body, intellect, have no consciousness of their own. How do they function? They need consciousness to function. So what they claim, it's either the term they use, some commentators use the term borrowed consciousness, some say reflected consciousness. From where? From Purusha. From the consciousness of the Purusha or the Atma or the soul, it's either a borrowed consciousness that Buddhi takes over and then Buddhi starts functioning, doing its own job, okay, or it's the reflected consciousness, as they say, whatever term, okay. And they go into so much detailed discussion, you know. These sutras, there's one book by Swami Veda Bharati. He has spent about 30 to 40 pages on each one of these sutras, just to explain minute details. Most of it is not understandable by me, so I don't know. Okay?
So I always think about it as it's like mind, body are resources.
Yes.
To the soul.
Yes, it's coming. It's coming.
Okay.
It's coming in the next couple of sutras. It's very good.
Okay. And the analogy I like to think is like using a computer by itself has no intelligence or computing power, but based on what we feed into it, lending intelligence
Human intelligence is still required.
Consciousness, yeah.
That becomes the consciousness counterpart.
Right.
That's very good.
Make it alive and
right.
Real work.
Right. Very true. But it's because of this ignorance that avidya that we talked about, you know, the ego takes over basically. Ego begins to think that this is the supreme master and it can take charge and it can control everything. And ego has its own issues, you know, it always looks at those labels and then decides, if I like something, I'm going to do it. If I don't like, if the label says like it, I'm going to do it. If the label says don't like it, I'm not going to do it. Whether it's good or bad, it doesn't matter to the ego. It goes purely by, you know, the terms used in one of the Upanishads for these two is, you might have heard the term Preyas and Shreyas. Anybody? Have you heard the terms?
Heard, but I forgot.
Yeah, the Sanskrit terms. Preyas is something that's pleasant. Shreyas is something that's desirable. Now, what's pleasant may not be desirable, and what desirable may not be pleasant. So he says you have to learn how to distinguish between prayas and shreyas, what is desirable versus what is pleasurable. Now, this we have talked about several times. You know, there is this whole concept of the inner instrument, mind-body complex, so to say, which is a composite of four functions. The mind, the thinking mind, and the intellect. Intellect is the buddhi, the discriminatory function, which allows you to pick between, dissect multiple choices. Okay, that's buddhi. Then there's the ego, which is all the identification and then, you know, putting that whole concept of I, capital I, and me and mine and all that into the picture. And of course the memory, which is the all the storehouse of the samskaras, vasanas, and all the memories that we have. These are the four functions of the mind. And what we want to do is to actually allow the intellect to do all the decision making. Intellect. But in our confused state of the mind as it is now, the intellect is confused itself, because intellect has given the responsibility over to the ego. Okay, and then ego makes decisions. And when I said ego looks at the labels and then makes decisions, that's problem. It's going to just say like it, not whether desirable. It does not look at anything as desirable or undesirable. It only says like it, dislike it, love it, hate it. That's it. Repeat it. So ego only picks the prayas, but when we transfer the control to the intellect, it knows how to pick the shreyas, not the prayas. You get the idea? Distinction between prayas and shreyas, pleasurable and desirable. Those are the two terms used in the Upanishad. One of the Upanishads called the Kathopanishad. Anybody heard the term Kathopanishad? Don't worry. Okay. So they also say that the beginningless association, this whole avidya thing, is also anadi. It's also beginningless. We are born with that avidya. We are born with the ego dominating. We are not born with self-realized people. So that's why we are born with ego dominant compared to the intellect. Okay.
Isn't there some people can be born?
Some people are born at a very high level of consciousness. And that's how they get, either they are born liberated or they get liberation in this lifetime itself. And there are always these names that pop up in our culture, you know, Ramana Maharishi. One example, they all, anybody heard the name?
Yes.
Ramana Maharishi?
Yes.
He was always given that. Even people like Vivekananda, you heard the name Vivekananda?
Yeah.
Or Yogananda, the guy who wrote the book.
Autobiography of a Yogi.
And then,
Now, would you say he's born self-realized? I mean, he did study.
He probably was born at a level of consciousness which was high enough
to at least say, I need to pursue this.
I need to pursue this, and he probably realized, he attained self-realization while he was still alive.
Yes.
Okay. So that's why, because they have to be at that level so that you can pursue that very strongly, mm-hmm. ardently.
And I was wondering, studying, is that independent of self-realization? As in knowledge?
It's an aid.
Right. So what I'm thinking is, even if you're self-realized, or born self-realized, you may still need to study or learn. Self-realization and knowledge, are they,
That's it. That's the ultimate knowledge. Self-realization is the ultimate knowledge.
Okay.
There's nothing more to learn after that.
I see. Okay.
Then you just impart knowledge to others.
Okay.
Because once you're self-realized, then you're still going to go through your life based on your prarabdha karma. Whatever karma you are dished out with, you still have to go through that. That may, you know, all these people, they had either cancer or some serious ailment. They were self-realized, but they had to go through this suffering because that's what was written in their karma. But they don't need to learn anything new. I mean, they just need to impart that their understanding to everybody else. That's what they do then. They just give talks and impart their understanding to others so they can come closer to self-realization. So, you know, understanding the cause of suffering, that's most important, and then trying to deploy appropriate means. So this is one of the, you know, the commentators, he gives the example of a thorn. And if you put the foot on the thorn, it causes suffering. Okay? So if you're walking in a thorny place, it can cause suffering. So how do you prevent it?
Don't walk there.
Don't walk there. But if you have to walk there,
put on your shoes.
So this idea of avoiding future suffering, is it really to recognize the cause and not, you know, overcome the cause, or is it to experience the thing but not suffer due to the experience?
Both. It's you have to overcome the cause eventually to prevent that suffering from happening in future.
Or can you still step on the thorn, but it doesn't cause you to suffer anymore?
It will cause you suffering if you step on this thorn. I mean, eventually it's going to cause you suffering, right? If you keep doing it over and over again.
What about people, you know, they walk on coals and everything.
Yeah, but that's okay.
But their feet are still burned.
Yeah. Become aware of the cause and then eliminate the cause from your mind. So, again, what the commentator says, in the case of the buddhi, the suffering is caused by, you know, these gunas taking over. See, when you are dominated by sattva, okay, then sattva is all purity, all cleanliness, all pleasure, basically, in that sense. But if the rajas and tamas dominate, then that causes the cause for suffering. Rajas and tamas. Okay? Now, suffering can be at the mental level or the physical level. It says anxiety, craving, etc., mental sufferings, and physical indigestion, illness of any kind, etc. And the ultimate cause of suffering, as we said earlier, was avidya, ignorance. That's the ultimate cause. And, you know, avidya causes the ego to raise its ugly head. And ego gives rise to all these raga and dvesha, which is all the likes and dislikes. And when we have likes and dislikes, it develops abhinivesha, which is all the fear of change, fear of death, and fear of any kind of transformation that can happen in life. Parinama, as it's called. That the word Patanjali used was parinama. Parinama means change, transformation, a result of something.
So, what are the examples of rajas and tamas?
Rajas is action, gung-ho activity, okay, you know, where you are only ambitious of something, you know, that's caused by rajas. Mm. Action, mobility, okay. Tamas is dullness, lethargy, sleepiness, negative thinking, that's also tamas, you know, desire to kill somebody, desire to steal, that's a combination of tamas and rajas.
Right.
You know, so there are gray areas between rajas and tamas and sattva, but combinations of these are also causing all these actions to be happening.
And sattvas?
Sattva is
ignorance?
Sattva is what?
Sattva is
knowledge.
Is knowledge?
Sattva is knowledge, purity, understanding. That's sattva. Ignorance is tamas.
I always thought of sattva as peacefulness.
Yes, peacefulness, yeah. Peace comes with knowledge.
Yes.
Okay. Lack of knowledge, avidya causes agitation of the mind, pain, which is not peace.
So by studying the sutras, gaining more understanding of all of this, we are able to manage to have sattva as our dominant state?
Yes. Okay. Eventually, like we mentioned in the past, I think a couple of sessions ago, the goal is to make sattva as dominant first. But then they said, beyond sattva also, we want to transcend all the three gunas. To really attain self-realization. Because if you're still stuck with sattva, you're still attached to...
You're still one of the gunas. Yes.
So you're still attached to something. Even whether you're attached to sattvic things or rajasic, it's still attachment. So that the term they use in Bhagavad Gita, for example, they use the term gunatita.
Gunatita?
Gunatita. Atita means beyond, transcending.
Transcending the gunas.
Transcending the gunas. They call it gunatita. In Sanskrit. Eventual goal is to transcend the gunas also so that you can not be affected by any attachment of any kind.
Right.
Atit, isn't it? End?
Yes. Okay. Beyond. Atit means beyond. Transcending. Okay. End. Yep. So that means end of gunas or beyond the gunas or transcending the gunas. Guna atita. Any other thoughts on this one? Okay. So now this statement keeps repeating in many different contexts. It's keep coming that this avidya is beginningless. Beginningless means it is started from the very beginning of time. Very beginning of life, we are when we let's say this life begins at t equal to zero, we are born with that avidya. Like I said, otherwise we would be born self-realized if there was no avidya. Okay, so it's eternal, basically, that's avidya. Okay. Now, even though they are beginningless, but they are not endless. Because there is an end possible. Once you self-realize that conjunction disappears, that union between Purusha and Prakriti disappears at that point. Then you have a clear understanding of the separation. I keep repeating separation, but proximity is essential. Okay? Without proximity, you cannot function. So, I think we have been already saying all this now. This conjunction, this suffering can be ended by self-realization, or the separation between Purusha and Prakriti. Okay? Now, this is a definition of this Prakriti itself as to what exactly is Prakriti. Okay? Drishyam. Okay. So, the words are, I want to repeat, Prakash,
Prakash.
Kriya,
Kriya.
Sthiti,
Sthiti.
Shilam,
Shilam.
Bhutendriyatmakam. Can you repeat that?
Bhutendriyatmakam.
Bhutendriyatmakam. I'm going to now separate these words. Bhuta. Indriya.
Indriya.
Atmakam.
Atmakam.
So, Bhuta, Indriya, Atmakam.
Bhuta, Indriya, Atmakam.
When you combine those three words, it becomes Bhutendriyatmakam.
Bhutendriyatmakam.
Bhoga.
Apavarga artham.
So it becomes bhoga apavarga artham. Drishyam. You need a little bit of Sanskrit, understanding of all these sandhis. And can anybody read Sanskrit?
Yeah, I've studied it from here. I've studied it Sanskrit.
So you know a little bit.
Sandhis and samas.
Okay, right.
Yeah,
right. Very good.
It's complicated. Like
the
5-10 words combined.
Oh, yes. That's very common. Okay. So now, this is a very basic sutra which describes or kind of defines what Prakriti is all about. Okay? And again, these are all Sankhya philosophy. This is all based on Sankhya philosophy. There are much more details given in the Sankhya philosophy. This is a condensed version of it, but fairly detailed understanding of what these concepts are. So now, we have said that Prakriti is nothing but a composite of these three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas. Sattva, rajas, and tamas. Okay. Now, those are the terms used in the Sankhya philosophy. Patanjali has used three totally different terms to represent the same concepts. But how do you know that? Because the commentators say so. Okay. What is prakasha? Prakasha means light or illumination. They say Patanjali means sattva by saying prakasha. Prakasha means light or glow or illumination. That's prakasha. Kriya means action. Kriya means activity, action, movement. And commentators say that means rajas. Okay. Sthiti means stability. Sthiti means no movement. Sthiti means something that is staying, stay put.
No change.
And that is dullness. I'm sitting in my couch, you know, eating my potato chips and drinking beer, and that's all I want to do. I don't want to move. That's, again, the commentator say that means it is tamas. So, prakash, kriya, and sthiti, these three have been equated with sattva, rajas, and tamas. Okay? So those are the basic components of drishyam. Drishyam means seen, something that is seen. What is seen? Prakriti. Seer is the purusha. Seer is the soul or the atma or the self. And what it sees is prakriti, mind, body, everything, and all the experiences that come through that. That is Prakriti. Okay? So, what it says is, Prakash Kriya Sthiti Shilam. Shilam is of the nature of. Shilam means of the nature of or composed of. So, this Prakriti is of the nature of these three gunas, Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas. And also, it's composed of Bhuta and Indriyas. What are Bhutas? Elements. And I'll come to the details here next in the next slide. But the basic understanding, bhutas are all the elements. Indriyas are the?
Sense organs.
Sense perception, sense organs. I'm coming to that details. Okay, so prakash, kriya, sthiti, that's one component of the prakriti. Sattva, rajas, and tamas. It also constitutes of the bhutas and indriyas, which are the elements and the sense organs or sense perceptions. And what's the purpose? Bhoga and apavarga is the purpose of this. That's what you were talking about. Bhoga means
experiences
of the life. Okay, bhoga. And apavarga means liberation. Apavarga means liberation. Okay. So the purpose of this prakriti is to provide bhoga and apavarga for the purusha. So we are providing experiences and eventually total liberation from this whole sansara, from this whole life. This life story of life and death, etc., cycle of rebirth, etc. We are giving that liberation to that purusha. So it's a very pregnant sutra. So commentators have a long explanation on this sutra. All right. So these are the notes that I have made here based on what I have read. Now, gunas are always in flux, as I mentioned, they are constantly in flux. Every moment there is a change in the gunas. Okay? So you are...
Guna, what does exactly guna mean?
Guna is... Everything in this universe is based on gunas. So mind is a composite of three gunas. Your food is a composite of three gunas. You know, they always say this is sattvic food, this is rajasic food. Your everything. Gita has a whole discussion on these gunas. It even says when you give charity, it could be either sattvic charity or rajasic charity or tamasic charity.
Building blocks of everything.
Building blocks of everything. That's right. So gunas are
commonly heard in the context of food, though.
Yeah. Food, mind. You know, constantly thought of in the mind also. That, you know, I have a sattvic mind, I have a rajasic mind, etc., etc. Thoughts, you know, actions.
Actions
are very commonly talked about, sattvic actions, etc., etc. But food is also very commonly mentioned in terms of sattvic, rajasic, and tamasic. Okay, so, but the point is, they're always constantly changing. Okay, so... The other day, you know, I put my milk to boil, and I forgot that, and then I sat down and I started meditating. So I sat in my meditation in a sattvic frame of mind, and suddenly, you know, I realized, oh my God, I have put milk for boiling, and rajas took over right away. That sattva was thrown out of the out of the whole scene. I ran to my kitchen. Fortunately, it wasn't done yet. So these things, this just happened a few days ago. So gunas can change like this.
Is it like sort of, gunas is how things are like relate to each other.
In what way?
Like our how our body, like for example, for the food, like how our body like relates to the food.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily the food itself; it's like the correlation to the body.
Well,
or is it the? Is that a?
Sattva means, you know, the food itself will be characterized as having sattvic qualities.
Yeah.
The energy, you can say, you know,
yeah,
associated with the food will represent sattva.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, same thing with rajasa. For example, very spicy food, they always say is rajas.
Right.
It gives you active, it makes you active. So it has an impact on your body.
Yeah.
So if it has a positive impact, it's sattvic. If it has a very energizing or very agitating impact, that's like, rajasic.
Or for thoughts, and it doesn't, like, so it's, like there's a thought, but then it could be like the different types. Yeah.
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 Thought can be either rajasic thought, tamasic thought. You know, if your thought is that I want to hurt somebody or kill somebody, that's a combination of rajas and tamas. Okay. Everyone get the idea?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I just picked up these words from these commentators, you know, sattva is illumination, knowledge, awareness, pleasantness, lightness, etc., etc. Okay? Rajas is activity, motion, painfulness, ambition. Tamas is inertia, retention of potentiality, delusion, and heaviness. You know, some of the terms that commentators use to describe all these terms. You have to kind of sit down and understand these terms in depth on your own, basically. Okay? Kind of reflect back on these terms and get a deeper understanding of what these mean. And you may have to read a little more and also see how these words and these concepts apply to your own daily activities in life. Okay? So we can spend a lot of time. In the Bhagavad Gita, for example, there are almost 3 full chapters, almost entirely devoted to a discussion of the gunas. Okay, and then these commentators and these people who have written commentaries, they spend hundreds of pages on explaining all these gunas and all that. So it's a very deep subject. So now, this is what the whole concept of bhutas and indriyas comes to. You know, these 23 elements that we talked about. Does anybody remember the 23 elements? Every time it comes up.
I know, I have it written down.
What are the 23 elements?
Well, the elements are
earth,
fire, air.
Those are the bhutas, yes.
Okay, but that's also part of the elements.
Bhutas means elements, yeah.
Okay.
They are called the gross elements. Mm-hmm.
And then there is the sense of... I mean, your senses.
Yes.
Taste, touch, sight.
Yes. They are called tanmatras in Sanskrit. Mm. So five
feet.
Bhutas...
Hmm? Hand, feet.
Okay, so five bhutas, five... they are called mahabhutas, these gross elements. Earth, water, fire, air and ether. Five of those. Then five sense perceptions, the sense of taste, smell, touch, etc., etc. Five sense perception. For each sense perception, there is a sense organ. For the perception of taste, there is tongue. For the perception of sight, there is eyes. Hearing, there is ears. So they are called jnanendriyas. Okay, indriyas of perception. Input, knowledge. Okay, so five senses. So five bhutas, five senses, that's 10. Then five sense organs, that's 15. Then five organs of action, hands, feet, etc. What are the five sense organs of action? Hands, number one. Feet, number two.
Tongue,
number three, for speech. What are the other two?
Elimination, digestion.
Elimination and reproduction. Okay, so those are the five organs of action. They are called karma indriyas in Sanskrit. Karma. So there is karma indriyas, they are the organs of action, and then jnana indriyas, the five organs of perception. Okay, so that makes us 20. And we still have to deal with three more. What are these three?
Buddhi, intellect, or
something. Yes, mind, buddhi, mind, intellect, and the ego. Okay, so manas, buddhi, ahankara. All right. Now, what the way they describe these is that everything is kind of divided into cause and effect situation, cause and effect. So the way, this is all Sankhya philosophy. There is no real explanation given. And if you read the Sankhya text, this is how it is. No explanation given. So what they say is, from this Mula Prakriti, from this root, unmanifest Prakriti, when there was an imbalance in the three gunas, when Rajas took over, somehow Rajas became dominant. Rajas is the one which does creativity, which does creation. The first thing that got created was the intellect. I don't claim to understand all this tree of creation. But that's how it is given in the Sankhya. Nobody seems to explain why it is so and what does it mean. First thing that was created was the intellect, buddhi. And from buddhi came up ahankara. Okay? And ahankara created these 10 or 11 senses. What are the 10? 11 senses? Five sense organs. Five sense perceptions and the mind. Mind is considered one of the senses because without mind nothing works, right? Okay. And then also it created the five sense. So we said five organs of action, five organs of perception, and then five senses, which is called tanmatras, all right? So those are all given here. So this is what it is now. The five gross elements, earth, water, fire, etc., they are the elements which are at the very end of the chain. Okay, so cause and effect. Okay, where is the sutra now? Let me just go back to this. This is all right. So they can be divided into gross and subtle. That's the whole idea they are talking about, gross and subtle. Okay, subtler you are, the more that becomes the cause. Gross becomes the effect. So bhutas, or the five elements, are the effects of subtle elements called the tanmatras, sense of smell, etc. Sense of smell gives rise to earth. Sense of taste gives rise to water, etc., etc. All right? So those are, again, concepts which take a fair amount of understanding, fair amount of time to conceptualize and understand these concepts. All right? And I'm still trying to understand these things. So I cannot claim to be an expert and explain to you everything that's a part of this. This is where my study is right now. You know, I'm trying to understand, grasp these concepts from Sankhya philosophy. Very deep concepts here.
So, with all these elements and senses, if you are a human being who lives every day and experiences all these senses, and then things happen in your life where you have to act and react, the goal is to deal with them in an effective manner so you're not causing yourself to perceive that there's a union of the seer and the seen. Is that what we're trying to work toward?
Well,
because you have to, I mean, as a person in real life, you have to handle things and you get input from
right.
Other senses. And
so if we deal with situations in life based on our ego being the dominant entity, that's going to give us suffering. And if we deal with situations in life based on the dominance of the intellect, buddhi, which is going to choose only the shreyas, which is the desirable as opposed to the pleasurable, then we are in a better shape.
So you're trying to develop the awareness of what's happening yourself.
Yes.
So you can go down the right path.
Right. Mm. Right.
Also, isn't it like I kind of think about this as you have to be aware of all of this and how things work or how
yes.
that happens.
Yes.
So that, I mean, and to me also, I mean, I tend to think very analytically. So once I know how it works, I mean, I can predict, I can, you know, play around with it, how to make the right choices.
Make the right choices based on the buddhi.
Right. So
always keeping the back of the mind that we are trying to get to a point where all the decisions are made by the buddhi, intellect, not by the ego. So that means we are trying to avoid any involvement with the likes and dislikes, raga and dvesha, attachments and aversions.
So in a way, using intellect to be self-aware, I mean, be aware of the
yes.
Prakriti.
Yes.
And once I know Prakriti, in a way, I can maybe deduce what is Purusha or Ras. Is
that's right.
Something like that.
Because that's all we have to deal with. You know,
so
that's very beautifully said, because understanding of the Purusha will come only as an inference.
Exclusion of
as an inference.
Prakriti.
You said deduce, in inference.
Yeah.
It will come as an inference from our total understanding of Prakriti.
Prakriti, yeah.
That's very true. Okay. That's in the... So, again, what it's saying is there are some gross elements and there are some subtle elements. In terms of the bhutas, the gross elements are the five elements, earth, fire, water, etc. And the subtle elements are the five senses of smell, taste, touch, etc. Those are the subtle at the bhuta level, at the element level. At the indriya level, there are five organs of action and five cognitive senses. Okay, the indriyas are the jnana indriyas and the karma indriyas, and that's the gross elements. Then subtle is the buddhi and the ahankara. Okay, that's at the subtlest level. Buddhi is the most subtle of all the subtle elements. Buddhi, intellect. Okay, tamas, gross and subtle elements of the bhutas, rajas, 10 gross senses, that's the indriyas, and sattva is the subtle senses, mind, ego and the intellect. That's how they have divided this whole thing into sattva, rajas and tamas. Okay. And then what is the purpose of all this? Like I said, purpose of all this prakriti is to provide bhoga and what's the other term they use? Apavarga. Apavarga. Apavarga means liberation, self-realization. Bhoga means to provide experiences of life, pleasurable or unpleasurable, painful or pleasurable. That's bhoga. And how do you do the bhoga? How do you get to the bhoga? This is all based on the karma. So whatever is in the prarabdha karma, that's number one. Then the agami. Remember there are three karmas that we talked about? Does anybody remember the names? Three karmas? Prarabdha karma. That's called sancheta karma. So prarabdha karma is what you are dished out as the part of karma for this lifetime, this lifespan. Then sanchit karma is that whole bag of karma that's accumulated from times immemorial, multiple lifetimes. And agami karma is what you now are putting in your life, in your bag. Now whatever you're doing now as a part of your free will, as a part of your free will activities, that's called the agami karma.
Which okay. will go on to the next lifetime unless you become self-realized.
That's right. That's right. Okay? So, the experiences that we have, they are based on our prarabdha karma as well as agami karma. Okay? So, whether you have a sickness or promotion or whatever, you know, they claim that much of it is based on either on prarabdha karma or something that we have, you know, accumulated ourselves as the agami karma.
In a way, mix of destiny and what you...
Purushartha. So that destiny is your karma, right. And purushartha is the stuff that you put in.
Okay.
Have you heard the term purushartha?
Yeah.
Okay. So one is the prarabdha karma, that's destiny, and purushartha is what is going to give you the agami karma.
No, I mean, what I was thinking of is the experience is a mix of these two, destiny
yes.
and free will, in a way.
Yes, yes, exactly. Right. So what does Apavarga do for us? It gives you the freedom from cycle of birth and death as a result of self-realization. Okay? Now, all these things are happening, experience and the liberation, etc., apavarga and bhoga, they're happening in the buddhi. Okay, but they are attributed to purusha. Because what we're saying is, they are being presented to the purusha for purusha's experience. But they are happening, everything is happening in the buddhi. Purusha is just an observer, a seer, just sitting there watching. But we're presenting it, so an attributed to purusha. Vyasa in his commentary says it's just like in an army, the soldiers fight, okay, but the credit for victory or loss goes to the king or the commander-in-chief. So if you think of Purusha as the commander-in-chief, all the work is being done by the buddhi, but it's attributed to Purusha as finally becoming self-realized, etc., etc. Okay, so that's number 18. Okay. I think I'm going to... these are difficult sutras. And like I said, I don't claim to understand them 100%. I'm getting there slowly, but it's still taking me a long time to really grasp the very essence of these, okay?
So, I mean, the analogy that comes to my mind is it's essentially like a computer has to figure out how it works.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's like the intellect, with the help of intellect, I have to figure out how...
To lead my life?
No, I mean how I work. Or how,
yes.
So, mm-hmm. In a way, it's like imagining a computer has to figure out by itself how the computer works.
Okay.
Yeah.
In a sense.
And, you know, I'm using computer in the sense that I'm the seer. I'm the, you know, separate from my resource computer. And with the help of computer, it has to figure out how it works.
Right.
So that it will know it is different from me.
In a sense, yeah, that's a good example, I guess.
That's why we have these instructions.
Yeah.
Okay. But I do encourage you to, you know, pick up a couple of different commentaries and read these, because you really have to start reading and reflecting on each statement that's given in the texts and sit down and kind of meditate on these statements, because they take time to really give you a better understanding. It takes time.
There's books here if you want to see them.
I conduct leadership workshops.
Oh, really? Uh-huh.
And I actually use these concepts a lot.
Oh, really?
I think it's a mix of... So, and I learned a lot just by sharing and...
Sure, yeah, that's how you learn, yes. That's beautiful, yeah. In fact, you know, there are workshops that people offer based on Bhagavad Gita, on leadership, etc. And I actually attended one workshop on Bhagavad, on the leadership concepts as they are taken from Bhagavad Gita. They will take just 4 or 5 concepts and apply to corporate leadership, etc. You know, they're very beautifully done, mm-hmm. These workshops. There's a whole book on leadership through Gita, textbook or something. So yeah, these concepts are very, very applicable.
Yeah.
Oh, she has a lot of books that you can see. Those are the books that we follow in our study group. Okay, so I think I'm going to stop here today. All right.